First, I would like to talk about the de-divinization of the state. As Reverend R.J. Rushton has pointed out, the ancient pagans, basically, along with their modern counterparts, make a god of the state. The ancient pagans essentially divinized or made a god of civil government. Whether they looked to the offices of the rulers of civil government as being some sort of mediatorial positions between man and the gods, all these false gods that they worshiped, or any of the false gods that they worshiped, or whether they looked to the office of the king, shall we say, as being divine, or whether they looked to an elite to rule, or even the majority to rule. In essence, they placed absolutely no real enduring limits on the powers of civil government. They may, like Plato and other Greek philosophers, look to a race of philosopher kings to rule over them, or to one philosopher king to usher in the whole process. Or they may have simply looked to the majority to rule. But whatever the source of authority in the ancient city, or for that matter, the ancient empire, the civil government was established without limits. We can look back to ancient Rome, and Rome as a city really had no limits on it, on the powers that it could exercise over the individual citizen. The individual himself had no rights over against civil government. This was the case when Rome was ruled by kings. It was the case when Rome was ruled by the minority. It was the case when Rome eventually became a democracy. Now, Rome itself may have represented, or the power of the Roman government may have represented the whole people of Rome, but the main point is that there was nothing which stood above the people, above the will of whoever happened to have power. And even in ancient political philosophy, political thought, there was nothing really higher than those who ruled. No abiding, universally valid, easily knowable standards, such as God's laws, which stood over both rulers and the ruled, and which placed limits on the rulers. And the state was seen, really, as a divine link between men and the gods, a little cosmion, a little cosmos unto itself. So that even if you had a Socrates criticizing the Athenians for doing various things foolishly and so forth, Socrates still drank that cup of hemlock. And the reason he did drink that cup of hemlock was that he was showing his submission to the state. The state was greater than the individual. The individual had no rights over against the state. Every area of life, at least in principle, was under the authority of civil government. So that there really was no distinction, such as we draw biblically, between civil government on the one hand and, shall we say, the government of the family or the government of the church or other kinds of government. Civil government had authority over religion. It, at least in principle, had authority over education. And certain thinkers like Plato and Socrates wanted civil government to have total control over education, precisely so that the people could be made virtuous, supposedly, through the controls that the government exercised over education. The role of the philosopher kings was supremely to educate everyone in terms of the view of the world and of life and of right and wrong and so forth that the philosopher kings wanted them to have. So the ancient pagans really placed no authority over civil government. Sure, you may read Antigone, shall we say, Sophocles' famous tragedy, in which Antigone is making a religious appeal against the state. But what happens in Antigone? It is a tragedy. Antigone is condemned because there is no authority higher than the state. Now, there is no real clear revelation which stands above the state and says, thou shalt not, to rulers as well as to citizens. So the ideal was then that the civil government, the state, if you will, had authority over all areas of life. Whether it exercised it or not, it had that authority. And the citizen really had no legitimate gripe against civil government, no rights over against it. Now, it really was only with the coming of biblical religion or of Christianity that these limitations upon the state were removed. Certainly we can look back to the Old Testament and see that the civil government was limited. You've already studied the Hebrew Republic, so you know the ways in which it was limited and why it was limited. Let's just note a few reasons why for Christianity. The state cannot be made divine. When you make the state divine, what you do is to give it total power. In principle, total power. Whether it actually exercises control over all areas of life is simply a matter of the will of the ruler, you see. This is why in the ancient cities and empires and so forth, they didn't really have any true constitutionalism as we know it. The constitution of an ancient state or city-state or empire was basically simply a description of who had power and what he, she, or they had done with that power. It was a description of who ruled and what they did with the rule that they had. It did not place limits on the ruler, such as our Constitution was certainly designed to do. But with the coming of Christianity, this all had to change. For starters, the state cannot be made divine because it isn't divine. God alone is divine. God alone is sovereign. He alone is the Lord of the universe, the creator and sustainer of all things. Certainly we can apply this to Jesus Christ too. Jesus Christ is Lord, Savior, but he is also Lord. All power is given unto him in heaven and in earth. That means, obviously, that the state cannot have all power. Only God is sovereign. The state is not sovereign. For the state to claim that it is sovereign, either explicitly or implicitly, is, of course, heresy, untruth, and a fundamental violation of reality, a fundamental rebellion against the constitution of reality. Now, secondly, Jesus alone is Savior. The state, civil government, is not and cannot be the Savior of man. Certainly it cannot save him eternally by what it does, nor can it even save him temporally. Be sure it can do some things which are right and so forth, and it has a duty to do right. But it cannot save man, either as an individual or as society, because it is not sovereign. It does not have control over all things. Only the Lord of hosts has control over all things. He alone is sovereign. Civil government is necessarily limited in its authority as well as in its power. So to look to civil government to be our savior, either as an individual or as a nation, is a fundamental error. And a very deadly one, because then we seek to turn over to that civil government total power. We're making a god, an idol, a false god out of that civil government if we grant it total power. We're granting it something that it cannot possibly have. In addition, of course, Jesus Christ is the lawgiver. He is one with the Father. And we can go back to Malachi 3:6 and other passages in Scripture and see that the Lord changes not. He is unchanging. He is not a God who is one thing today and another thing tomorrow and another thing the day after tomorrow. He is unchanging, and His law is unchanging. He is the lawgiver who commands us to teach the nations to do all things whatsoever He has commanded us, and who tells us that if we love Him, we must keep His commandments. So He is the lawgiver. Therefore, He stands above civil government, all civil governments, whether it's your local government, your state government, your national government, or the United Nations, or any other pagan dream of man for one world government. Civil government is under the law of God. If you read Romans 13 carefully, and most Christians don't read it nearly so carefully as they should, you see that the purpose of civil government is to protect the good and to restrain and or punish the wicked, the evil. And as Mr. Rose pointed out to you, goodness and evil is defined or are defined in terms of God's word, not man's word. They're defined in terms of God's word and law, not man's word and law. So civil government then, no matter whether it's ruled by one man or one woman or a few men or women or by the majority of the people, is still under the authority of God and must go by, as long as it is to be just, must go by the authority of His revealed law word. The only other alternative is to be under the word of man. Those who divinize the state, who make a god of the state, really are making a god of whoever it is that happens to rule the state, whether that's one man, be he philosopher, king, or whatever, or hereditary monarch, what have you, be he a little elite aristocracy of rational philosopher or rationalistic philosopher, whether it be a scientific elite, or whether it be the majority which rules. The majority, the elite, the wise man, must submit to the word and law of God. The state can never be made divine. The state must be limited in its authority and power. Okay. Now we also notice, in addition, that civil government is an institution, as Romans 13 very clearly tells us, ordained by God. Established and ordained by God. The powers that be are ordained of God. They are ordained for His purposes. And they are ordained, we ought to notice, especially to be His ministers. They are to be ministers of justice. They are really no less ministers than the minister who preaches to you on Sunday is. They are to be God's ministers for righteousness, for justice, for good, and in opposition to evil. They wield the physical sword, as it were, not so much the sword of God's word, but they are God's ministers for good. Just as your minister who teaches you and preaches to you is duty-bound by the Lord who has ultimately ordained him to preach and teach the word of God, to teach the whole counsel of God, so also the civil officials are duty-bound by the very fact that they owe their positions to God, whether they recognize it or not. They are duty-bound to act in accordance with God's word and law, God's standard of justice, God's standard of goodness, and not to invent their own standard of law. They are not to remove the limits from them. In addition, of course, as Christians, we must recognize very clearly that civil government is only one institution that God has ordained. There are at least two others, namely the family I would argue precedes civil government, and the church, which you could argue precedes civil government. But the family church and civil government are all institutions of equal authority under God. No one is over the other two. You don't have the family over the church and over civil government. You don't have the church over the family and over civil government, and you certainly don't have civil government being in authority over the church and over the family. These two establish very clear limitations on the power and authority of civil government, on what it may justly do and what it may not justly or rightly do. All right, for at least these reasons, and I'm sure there are many others that we could come up with, civil government is limited then and must rightly be limited. But it has been the main thrust of modern pagan thought, which, as Albert Camus himself, an example of the very thing he's writing about, has pointed out in his little book, The Rebel, which is basically a survey of modern thought. Modern thought is in essence in rebellion against God. Rebellion against the God of Scripture, the Christian God, the true God. The essence of modern thought, from Machiavelli on down to the present, is rebellion of man, the creature, against his Creator. In which man essentially, going back to the ancient Greek Protagoras, and it's no accident that the humanists continually remind us how great the Greeks were, at least how great they say they were. Man, going back to the ancient Greek Protagoras, makes man the measure of all things. So rather than having God be the measure of all things, and God's revealed word and law in the Bible be the measure in terms of which we are to lead our lives, the word of man replaces the word of God. Now, it's not surprising that these men, like the folks at the Tower of Babel, who operated on the same premise, end up with different conclusions about which man and which man's word we ought to follow. For people who are basically rationalists, that is, who assume that man's reason is self-sufficient, does not need revelation, can solve all of man's problems on its own, then we should have a rationalistic elite rule over us. This is usually the thrust, although you do get some individualists who think that each individual ought to be free with no law of God over him to rule himself. We have anarchism. But basically the thrust is we ought to have a rational or rationalistic elite to rule over the rest of us dummies who are not ruled by our reason like they are, and who therefore believe in Christianity or various other systems of thought which don't square with a particular rationalistic school's understanding, or what they think is their understanding of the nature of things. For many men, we should instead be ruled by a scientific elite or a technological elite, which should make all of our decisions for us and manipulate us in accordance with the findings of science. And by the way, experiment on it a bit too, as is necessary. Since irrationalism is very much a part of modern thought, you do have men turning to great leaders, great hero leaders, Führers, as in Nazi Germany and that sort of thing, to lead us. You have people placing authority in the race, so that the race must be the guiding principle. We must follow the race, which means follow the leaders of the race, and so forth. Again, we're back to National Socialism, although not only to that. You have people who place authority in the nation. Certainly we've seen a lot of this in modern times, where the nation is deified, and we must follow our national traditions, or whatever the nation wants to do today. Or, of course, then we have the ultimate, the idea of mankind. We must follow mankind. Hubert Humphrey, who was a good liberal and so forth, wrote a book called The Cause is Mankind. And certainly one of the main thrusts of modern humanistic thought is that we must have one world government to rule over all of us. And that we must follow the desires and needs and so forth of mankind. Not the infallible word of the Lord, but the infallible word of mankind, which turns out to be the infallible word of those who are speaking for mankind to the rest of us, you see. Or you have, getting a little closer to home, and we ought to get back close to the USA for purposes of continuity here. We certainly, in modern decades, or in recent decades, have had the idea that the United States is a democracy and that we ought to follow what the majority will is. So this is another false god raised up by men. The majority will, the general will, what have you, must rule. All of these things, all of these false gods, essentially turn over to the civil government total power. Or turn over to whoever has control of the civil government total power. And replace the word and law of God with the word and law of whatever man or group of men happens to be ruling. And give the individual no right, really, over against the will of the majority, the will of the master race, or the will of mankind, so-called, or what have you. They essentially are different ways of divinizing the state. But the principle that unites them all is the same, that the civil government ought to have absolute authority. Our own civil government has been ruled by that principle for many decades now, and we are just beginning to see in a very concrete way some of the disastrous consequences of this. Of course, we've seen plenty of consequences of this in history. Now, the men who framed the Constitution were virtually all Christians. The men who ratified it were virtually all Christians. America was dominated by Christianity and so forth. While the framers of the Constitution did not explicitly, in so many words, I think they should have done so, but they did not say, this is a Christian nation. We are under the authority of the sovereign triune Lord of the universe. We are under the authority of his word and law. You did have some state constitutions which said this. And our civil government is going to be limited by the law of God. I wish they had done that. They did very clearly seek to design the civil government so that it would not have total power, and so that it would not be able to evolve into a system of total power, a system in which the church was under the state, the family was under the state, the individual was under the state in all areas of life, and so forth. By under the state, in this case, I mean the central government, or for that matter, any civil government. So while they did not explicitly say, this is what we're doing, if you look at the design of their government, it certainly is what they did. And I'd like to go into that just a little bit to outline for you how this was done. We discussed a good deal of that yesterday, but nevertheless, it will not hurt to review this. To begin with, they established a written constitution. The very purpose of that written constitution was precisely to place limitations on civil government. To fix things so that those in power, including those in Supreme Court, certainly including those in Supreme Court, supremely including those in Supreme Court, could not act as a constitutional convention in continuous session to change the Constitution at will and make it into a waxwork and mold it into whatever form they desired to do. And we ought to note that the framers very, very clearly wrote into the Constitution a process whereby it would be amended. And they made that process a very difficult process. Requires unusual majorities of Congress to even propose an amendment. Well, you have to get two-thirds of both houses to propose an amendment. And then three-quarters of the states to ratify the amendment, and so forth. very unusual majorities were required. Why? Because they did not want the government to have or to be able to acquire absolute power. I want to talk about this a little more extensively when we get to the rule of law, because they certainly wanted the rule of law and not the rule of men and to be the dominant principle here. We've seen, too, that when they designed this Constitution, they designed a very intricate, very elaborate system of separation of power. A separation of powers between that existed in the legislature itself, so that they divided the two houses into the House and the Senate, gave each a different operating principle, so that neither one could, so that they could not join together and dominate the other two branches of civil government. Then they divided power between the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary. And they wrote into that Constitution all sorts of limits on these various branches of government, as well as on the central government itself. Now, the Constitution was also intended to be an expressed powers document. I talked about that a little bit at the end of the session yesterday, but the fact that the Constitution was an expressed powers document meant that it had only those powers delegated to it by the states in the Constitution. It had no other powers. It did not have the power to create unto itself new powers. They weren't making it a god who could create things out of nothing. In fact, they did not want it to create unto itself new powers out of what it already had, either. Again and again, if you read the debates in the state ratification conventions, you see the supporters of the Constitution trying to reassure the opponents of the Constitution, or at least those who were persuadable, that the document was an expressed powers document, that the central government had no more powers than those given to it in the Constitution. The very fact that opponents of the Constitution were not reassured, that not enough people, and not enough the people's representatives, were reassured by this argument, is the reason why we have the Bill of Rights added to the Constitution. That certainly was another move to make sure that the state was de-divinized, that it had no more powers than those stated in the Constitution. That's why we have the Bill of Rights. And I might note, too, that the Constitution was intended to incorporate English common law. The Bill of Rights was basically a shorthand way of saying the common law, so far as it applies to America, still applies. The fact that the Constitution does not say we're going by common law does not mean that we don't still go by it. We haven't shifted to another legal base. We have not undertaken a legal revolution. So the common law which was basically founded on biblical principles which was founded on a Christian version of natural law thought which was founded on biblical law and which gave a very strong role to precedent that is, to previous legal decisions in courts of law involving concrete disputes among individuals. The common law was established as well. It was made clear that it was by the first nine amendments. Amendments 1 through 8 basically give you distilled forms of very, very important traditional legal rights under the common law and in American history that Americans had had, and that enough Americans fussed about to make it very clear that they wanted to retain them. Okay. Then the Ninth Amendment is a catch-all amendment to make sure that all those other rights that you have not stated in the Constitution are really there. Because during the ratification debates in the states, one of the main, well, really the main focus of argument between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists was whether or not the Constitution included the common law and all those traditional rights and liberties which were not stated in the Constitution. The Anti-Federalists said, I don't see them in there, therefore they're not there, therefore we need a Bill of Rights. The Federalists, the supporters of the Constitution, on the other hand, said, no, we don't really need to list these common law rights, these traditional rights you have, because the Constitution is an express powers document. It doesn't take away any of these rights, therefore you still have them. On top of that, if we try to list all of this multitude of traditional common law rights that you have, we couldn't do it. We might leave some out. And if we left some out, that might suggest that you no longer have them. So it's better just not to list them. But most folks did not buy that argument and said, no, siree, we want a list of those things. So we have the Ninth Amendment as a catch-all, which says that the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage the existence of other rights that people also retain, or words to that effect. So it says basically that we still have all these other rights, even though we haven't listed them anywhere in the Constitution or the previous amendments to the Constitution. Another move to de-divinize the state, to place limits on the powers of civil government. In this case, specifically of the central government. Now, the Constitution was also a reserved powers document. It was the states which really had gotten together to commission their representatives to meet, formulate a constitution, ratify the constitution, and so forth. It was the states which delegated certain powers to the central government by way of the constitution, and also which forbade to themselves certain other powers, such as the power to coin money or to have the states control foreign policy or regulate interstate commerce. Those sorts of things. The states, however, did not give up all the rest of their powers simply because they had created or had delegated certain powers to the central government in the Constitution. The states still wanted to keep those powers. The people of the state certainly wanted their states to keep the powers that they had had. So, we have then the Tenth Amendment, being added to the very end of, what we call, loosely speaking, the Bill of Rights, to make it clear that the states still retain all those powers which they have not delegated to the central government nor forbidden to themselves. And the Tenth Amendment reads that those powers not, this is a rough paraphrase now, not delegated by the states to the central government are reserved to the states or to the people. Now, you need to watch out for that last little phrase, or to the people, because the liberals love to say, well, that means that the central government, which represents the people, can change the Constitution as it goes along through judicial fiat or whatever way, presidential action, what have you. But the people could only have meant the people of the states. That was the clear intention of the people who framed the Tenth Amendment. It was the clear intention of the people who ratified it, and so forth, that the people of the states retained the powers that they had not delegated to the central government. So it made very clear the deal, you might say, between the states and the central government that was designed into the Constitution. Right. So the states reserved those powers. The states were limited in their powers and authority. In fact, they limited themselves, circumscribed their own powers in framing the Constitution. The local governments, which were under the states, were limited, and certainly the federal government, the central government, was intended to be limited. Lots and lots of checks, then, on the central government. We've seen already, in talking about the system of separation of powers and checks and balances, that properly understood, it includes not only the separation of powers and checks and balances that take place in the central government, so that these various institutions, the House, the Senate, the Supreme Court, the President, and so forth, have partial checks on each other, partial controls on each other. But also, and doubly importantly, separation of powers exists between the states and the central government. Very, very important point that we've tried to stress here these few days. It used to exist that way. We don't have so many checks as we used to, but they deliberately designed it that way so that the states, through their legislatures in particular, could place brakes on the central government, could stop it when it was moving to exceed its powers and to act tyrannically or unjustly. Yes?
But when you look at the war between the states, especially nowadays, let's say Virginia decided that when the federal government was growing too big, they wouldn't secede from the Union. The first thing that would happen is that you'd have National Guard and everything in here.
Yes, I intend to talk about this tomorrow. But in essence, you have the Constitution being modified by means of, bullets and cannonballs and that sort of thing, rather than by constitutional scholarship. Of course, there was a constitutional issue involved, Southern states maintaining what the New England states had maintained in 1814, namely that we're parties to a compact which has been formed by the states. And even though the Constitution begins with "we the people of the United States," that does not mean that this is a centralized government. As a matter of fact, this was a point that was made repeatedly in the state constitutional conventions. The anti-federalists said, look, the Constitution begins with "we the people of the United States." That means they've created a centralized system, what they called a unitary system. And the Federalists, the proponents of the Constitution, the guys who wanted the Constitution passed, said again and again, no, it doesn't mean that at all. It doesn't mean we've created a centralized system. So, I would say that strictly speaking, and there are other things that could be said, you can even see in the Federalist Papers that they say the Constitution is a mixed form of government, formed on the basis of the states, but also on the basis of the nation. I think that the South had the better side of the argument. They just didn't have enough troops and so forth. And therefore, today we go by the dictates of the winning side. I will argue tomorrow that the so-called Civil War was a period in which the Constitution really got derailed fundamentally. And on top of that Lincoln, who is sainted by many people, almost deified by many people, was very responsible for derailing our constitutional tradition, and that he knew exactly what he was doing. A lot of his more intelligent supporters are convinced that he did and think it's a good thing that he did. having a different worldview, I disagree with that. But in any case, it would be very tough for a state to secede these days. There's no doubt about that. But I would argue that the changes that have come about in the Constitution because of the so-called Civil War were not changes that were passed even constitutionally. The 14th and 15th Amendments very clearly were passed at bayonet point and not as a result of the free deliberations of all the states and that sort of thing, the state legislatures. So what we're dealing with today is a radically different constitution than what they had, what the framers intended to design. And I would argue that they did intend for states to be able to secede. Certainly the compact theory upon which it was based left room to secede. If you're a member of a compact, and the Constitution was a compact, it was basically a covenant. If the other party breaks the compact or the contract, you're not bound to go on honoring it. the contract can be abrogated. You may honor it if you wish, but you also may say, okay, the contract is broken. You violated it, therefore I'm no longer bound by it. This is good contract theory. And as a matter of fact, Alexander Hamilton, who was the biggest centralizer among the founding fathers, argued basically the same thing. And this leads us to good old Federalist 28. I pointed out already some of the mechanisms by which the states could act through the governmental process to redress the grievances against the would-be tyrannical central government. Direct election of senators being the key device, but also something of a voice through the members of the House of Representatives, who, after all, are elected from districts within their states and not, let's say, on a regional basis or on a nationwide basis. See, we can spend a lot more time thinking about those things, but I'll just throw that out. Through the legal process, the states could exert pressure against the central government and get it to check its course. But keep in mind, you need to read Federalist number 28. You also need to read it to others. Because Alexander Hamilton, the big centralizer, sets forth in Federalist number 28 as an argument for the ratification of the Constitution, the argument that the states can more readily check and resist central government tyranny, even if it gets to resorting to military force. Even if it gets to the stage of military force, this resistance can be more readily carried out through a federal system, which gives you, after all, the state legislatures and governors, so that you have your lesser magistrates to guide and lead the people in their resistance effort and to work with the lesser magistrates in other state governments against the tyrannical central government. Whereas if you have a centralized government with every local official, shall we say, owing his position not to the folks in the local area or the state area, but rather to the folks in Washington, D.C. or Moscow or take your pick, wherever it is, then it's much more difficult to resist. You don't have any governmental machinery in your hands, you might say. So Hamilton says this is the way to go. He does, of course, say that before you resort to arms, you have recourse through Congress, especially through the senators. And he says, here's another interesting principle of human nature we see in the Federalists. The self-interest of the people involved in the state government is going to make them want, was going to make them love the power that they have. They don't want to surrender that power anyway. So they're going to have a self-interest in protecting their power against the encroachments by the central government. And on top of that, being smarter than the average voter, more knowledgeable than the average voter, more knowledgeable about civil government, what's cooking in politics and that sort of thing, they will be better able to spot at a distance threats to the rights of the people and the powers of the state and take the steps necessary to check that centralizing tendency or those threats to the people's rights and liberties. And he says, ultimately, though, everything is back in the hands of the people, and everything depends upon their vigilance to defend their liberties. This, too, is part of the system. The people can throw themselves into the scale, he says, on either side, on the side of the central government or on the side of the state government to resist. And it's by no accident, just parenthetically, that we have the Second Amendment to the Constitution being added, the right to keep and bear arms. Okay? That fits right in with this right to resist centralized tyranny. Not only so you can protect yourself, it is for that purpose. But,
I don't want to keep you on this.
Sure. Okay. Well, these are some more points I wanted to make on down the line anyway.
All right. I'm wondering whether you know offhand where, if anywhere, in the Federalist Papers is an explanation of interposition of states against the central government. Now, you're getting close to it. You're actually kind of describing it. But is there anything that was written in the Federalist Papers? I know Madison wrote in 1830. Felix Morley wrote commentaries on it later on. But in the Federalist Papers itself,
Was there anything that would have been written that caused the Kentucky Revolution, the resistance to the Alien Sedition Act?
I would say that... Okay. Offhand, strictly speaking, I don't know of any essay written on interposition. But I would say Federalist 28 comes as close as you want to get to it. Because the same principle is essentially there. Sure. And it is one, significantly, that is neglected. And by the way, Irving Kristol, one of the neoconservative intellectuals, pointed out in 1976 that with all the rhetoric about the bicentennial, the one thing that had been forgotten... Well, of course, I would argue it wasn't the only thing that had been forgotten. The one thing that had been forgotten was the right to revolution, which virtually all of these people believed in and had just finished practicing against this tyrannical central government.
That's what so. Happened to the
state. Well, there were governors who tried that. Governor Kirk in Florida tried that in about the late 60s or so, but it didn't fly very well. Yes. However, I do think that it is the duty of civil magistrates to do that, and they ought to do it. Tom, you all ought to read Tom Rose's essay in the Journal of Christian Reconstruction of a few years ago on interposition. There were instances of interposition carried out on up through the period of the Civil War, or the late unpleasantness, the War of Northern Aggression, what have you. Yes.
What do you see the role of the governor of the state? It seems as though the governor of the state had more power than actually the person of the United States. Per se, because the governor was sort of like the president of this province.
Well, I would say that actually he had less powers. I don't claim to be an expert on this, but one of the things they wanted to do was to limit the power, that is, after the War for Independence, since they'd had such bad experiences with royal governors, powerful governors, was to limit the powers of the governors, which they did. The governors today, generally speaking, have a lot more powers than governors back in those days did. And one of the things that was done, I would say, to the presidency was to, while it was checked and limited by various devices put into the Constitution, various powers given to Congress, was that the president was given certain attributes of his office which gave him more powers than the state governments had. Okay. And you can even look at characteristics of his office, like the fact that he was able to be in office for 4 years and to succeed himself in office. It was a very important point.
What was the role of the state militia?
All right, the state. Now, we ought to distinguish, let me relate this to the Second Amendment, if I may. You had both an organized and an unorganized militia. The unorganized militia was everybody who had firearms, I guess. And that the reason for the passage of the Second Amendment was so that you could take advantage of both militias, you might say, to defend against external attack or governmental tyranny. So that the state militia, of course, was under the governor of the state, ultimately under the president, but the state militia could be called out by the governor to defend the state immediately. And it doesn't make any sense to argue, as a lot of gun control advocates do, that the Second Amendment really means that we ought to have all our weapons put in arsenals, which can easily be seized by the enemy. But if you have an armed citizenry, like they had back then you may have some weapons that are kept in arsenals and that sort of thing, and some organized militia, but you also have a lot of folks out there with shooting irons who can give the enemy a good deal of difficulty, and resist his incursions until you can get help from the central government and or from the other state militias and so forth.
Yes. We've got another quick question. Okay. For the fire engine, but, what about, it seems that Washington is semi-favored of standing army.
And a lot of folks did not.
I understand.
Yes, that's right.
Maybe just comment a couple of things on that. Because,
right.
Was it because he just came to come out of revolution? What are your own feelings on that? Because I know that the intent sometimes of these members as well to limit the militia to the state and not to have a national standing army of Tennessee.
Yes. Many people who opposed the Constitution opposed it because of the idea of a standing army, which they thought was a distinct threat to liberty.
Where was that in the Constitution?
Beg your pardon?
Where was that in the Constitution for standing army?
Well, they thought they saw that it would establish a standing army, And so they figured that it would, I'm thinking, as, even as late as the 1870s, you do have the secularists, the Liberal League, whose program I read to you, complaining against the use of chaplains in the militia, not in the standing army.
Right.
but let me just get back to Washington, if I may. Washington was one of the most numerous group of framers of the Constitution who wanted a stronger central government for military reasons. Dr. Bradford, in his book, A Worthy Company, this book of biographical sketches of the framers, calls these men military federalists. Most of them were Southerners, who had seen the bad effects of a lack of well-organized resistance to the British and a lack of help from other states during the War for Independence. Washington, having seen that, especially in his position as general, who was commander-in-chief of our military forces, figured that it would be a good thing for us to have that national strength so that we could be respected by other nations and that sort of thing. Well, maybe that's the best way to leave it there.
Jefferson decreased the Navy, and he went to the opposite.
Yes. Well, by Jefferson's time, you were beginning to see some of the tensions between North and South, and a number of the Federalists who at first favored a stronger central government became essentially what we might call anti-Federalists and went over to Jefferson's side and took a position against a more centralized, stronger central government and for a more decentralized, more strongly federal government, shall we say. All right. There are many devices that were built into the Constitution to protect, in other words, against a centralized government or a centralizing government, which would arrogate unto itself more and more power. In the interest of time, let me just shift to another intimately related topic. That is the rule of law and not of men. The Founding Fathers wanted, and told us again and again they wanted, to have a government that would be established according to the rule of law and not of men. Now, the rule of law is intimately related to the de-divinization of the state, because the rule of law is a rule according to fixed, publicly known principles of law, which stand above the government, above the civil government, so that we, the citizens, as well as the rulers, can know what the limitations of the government are, what the standards are by which civil government is to operate, so that no one has any doubts about what powers the government should have, the civil government should have, and what powers it should not have, about what it should do and what it should not do. Strictly speaking, the only true rule of law that you have is the rule of God's law, because God is unchanging and His law is unchanging. And because he has revealed to us in the Scriptures His word and law. All we have to do is read the Bible to see it. I think one of the main shortcomings of the Constitution was that the Founding Fathers did not, in fact, state in the preamble or somewhere, this Constitution is framed in accordance with God's laws, and God's law stands over this Constitution. I think that that was implicit in what they were doing, that they intended the Constitution to be consistent with God's laws, and as a matter of fact designed this intricate framework of government, of civil government, including the state governments and the local governments as part of the system, to embody God's laws, to protect those principles of God's laws. It would take longer than I have to argue that. But nevertheless, I think this is what they intended. However, they should have put it down on paper for us and didn't. Nevertheless, they wanted a government that would rule in accordance with what they saw as natural law or the law of nature, the teachings of the Bible, English common law, and so forth, or the portion of English common law that applied to the states once they'd been separated from England. Now, the opposite of the rule of law is the rule of men. The rule of men, as you might suspect, is not rule according to fixed, unchanging principles, but it's rather rule according to the will of those who happen to be in power. Whether that is one man you're talking about, whether it's a few men, or whether it's the majority, especially if it's the majority. This is why the Founding Fathers did not want a democracy, because they knew how changeable majorities are. They knew how easily swayed they are. They knew how unstable democracies are. So they designed the frame of government to avoid as much as possible the rule of men, and to foster and preserve as much as possible stability and the rule of law. Now, virtually all of these devices that we've talked about for the past couple of days, which were designed into the Constitution, and I have by no means talked about all of them, but I won't run through them again for you. Virtually all of these devices were designed to preserve the rule of law in the civil government over against the rule of men. What I want to focus on, though, in order to help you understand their desire for stability in the rule of law, is, first of all, some of the consequences of an unstable law, of a changeable law, or set of laws. If we can talk about a changeable set of laws, an ever-changing package of laws, I don't know. The Founding Fathers understood very well, or at least pretty well, the consequences of changeable laws. Best place to go to understand this, I think, is in Federalist number 62, although you can see it elsewhere. I was going to read you some quotes out of that, but I'll spare you those. They're excellent quotes, but I'm afraid time is fleeting from us. In Federalist 62, Madison, of course, we've already heard from Madison in Federalist 10 that unstable laws are one of the things that destroy popular government, destroy justice, and destroy liberty. So we already know we don't want unstable laws. But in Federalist 62, Madison goes into a little more detail for us. Then he tells us, first of all, that unstable laws undermine the respect of other nations for our nation. If our laws are continually changing, our policies are continually changing, and we don't have a long-range view of things, we don't pursue a systematic, steady course towards some objective, we don't stand on some principles, just as an individual who stands on no principles loses respect, so also a nation loses no respect. Loses respect. And the consequences of losing respect in international affairs are not pretty and not pleasant. If you lose the respect of other nations in international affairs, you as a nation are going to suffer. Madison and the framers knew this. Therefore, they sought to design the governmental system in a way that would enable us to earn the respect of other nations and to maintain the respect of other nations. Alexis de Tocqueville points out in Democracy in America, great work that you ought to read sometime or another, written in the 1830s, that democracies everywhere are inferior to forms of government run by little elites, aristocracies, he called them. Because democracies cannot pursue stable, long-run policies. So, because they're not pursuing a consistent course, a well-chosen objective, their neighbors who are pursuing such a course are able to do things which undermine the power of these nations. Well, certainly that is happening to us. Of course, we're helping that out a good deal, but I better not spend much time getting into that. That's one of the main problems with our own policy. We have not been consistent in our policies. And the communists who have been consistent in their overall goals, but who have been willing to, who have been very calculatingly changing their tactics, most notably between taking a hard-line stance against us and saying, ah, we want to have détente or peaceful coexistence or what have you. We're nice guys now. Come on and trade with us and loan us some more money and send us some more mini ball-bearing technology so we can MIRV our rockets to home in on various of your cities. The communists have been making gains at our expense precisely for that reason. Okay. Founding fathers wanted to design the government so that it would have institutions in it which were stable, so that we could have men, so that they would attract better men who would produce, or at least tend to produce, there were no guarantees, better laws, wiser, more stable, more far-sighted laws, which were good both for foreign policy purposes and for domestic policy purposes. Now, in addition, they wanted to have a stable government and the rule of law fostered through the institutions they designed and the constitution they designed. Because domestically, changing laws have disastrous effects. I'll just go over a couple of them. One of them that Madison points out very well is that if your laws are continually changing, so that nobody who knows what the law is today can know what it will be tomorrow, or the next day, or the next year, then everything is unstable. And people will not undertake long-range projects, which may be very well for the public good, for the good of the nation, as well as for the good of the individual or the group of individuals who are carrying them out. If they can't know that the law tomorrow will be in their favor, will be in the favor of carrying out this project, especially if there are great sacrifices, financial or otherwise, involved in these projects, what encouragement or inducement will they have to carry out these projects? This is one of the ways in which bureaucracy stifles small business by smothering it with all sorts of regulations, by continually changing the regulations and so forth. And Madison certainly had in mind economic undertakings, not only economic undertakings, but economic undertakings when he was talking about this. You will not get these long-range projects for the public good undertaken by people that involve a lot of sacrifice if your laws are changeable, because the law tomorrow may destroy the project or damage it so much that you can't bring it to pass. On top of that, Hamilton tells us in Federalist 71 or 2, I forget which one, I think it's 72, that one of the reasons we want to have a president be able to succeed himself in office is that he might be able to undertake great projects which are for the national good. Hamilton didn't say what those were. I doubt if he had the welfare state in mind. But if a man can only begin a project and then know that it's going to be cut off and that some other guy who is not able to successfully complete the project will take over, and that his pet project, which is for the national good, will be destroyed, and that his name may go down in flames with it, he's unlikely to undertake these projects. So, one of the reasons they wanted the president to be able to see himself in office was precisely for this reason, so that he would be able to undertake these long-range projects. All right, but Madison in Federalist number 62 tells us that the moral effects of a changing law are even worse. Because if the law, what does the law do? The law teaches us the difference between right and wrong, or at least it ought to. It teaches us what those who are making the law consider to be right and consider to be wrong. Because it says, thou shalt or thou shalt not. Right? Thou shalt not drive over 55 miles an hour or whatever. Thou shalt not steal. There are certain penalties attached to stealing and so forth. Tells us, it teaches us, it contains certain ethical teachings. Now, what happens if you are changing the law continually?
Changing morality.
That's right. Morality continually changes. So you're teaching the people that there are no fixed moral principles that we stand for. And that we see the consequences of that all around us. So you're undermining the morals of the people. If I have time, I want to talk about the founder's views of virtue and morality. These were here that they were not concerned about. They were very much concerned about. But we'll see what the clock does to it. It is a very, very important, very, very neglected point. One which needs to be redressed. All right. If you undermine the morality of the people, what are you going to be doing? You're going to be undermining their respect for the law, their obedience to the law. You're going to be creating chaos for yourself. So on the one hand, you're going to be promoting lawlessness and anarchy, something we see increasingly around us. But at the same time, what else are you going to be doing if the law is continually changing? If the law is continually changing, then what happens to the limitations on government? Okay, they disappear. They evaporate with the changing laws. You're teaching people there are no limits on civil government, and that those in power may do whatever they will. This is precisely the reason why the Constitution was designed the way it was, with all these limitations and so forth that I've put into it, that I've reminded you that were in it, that they put into it. All right. So the Founding Fathers then went through all these elaborate devices, separation of powers, checks and balances, written constitution, and so forth, to create a system that would be as stable as possible, at least as stable as they figured the people would accept. And they also designed the institutions of the central government to provide for stability. I just want to consider that briefly with you before we move on to virtue and liberty. We've seen already that they had designed the Congress into a House, which was basically democratic, and a Senate, which was, in a loose sense of the word, basically more aristocratic. And a presidency, which was in some ways aristocratic, in some ways a little bit monarchical. And a Supreme Court, which was in some ways the most aristocratic, least democratic, most undemocratic institution of the civil government. Now, we could take a lot more time and analyze these things, but you ought to go through some time and look at some of the various things that we've considered. The way that these men were elected. The House was directly elected. The Senate was indirectly elected. Certainly the pretend that that's two eyes. That the president was indirectly elected through the Electoral College, very carefully designed system, even though it hasn't worked all that well because of parties. And the Supreme Court was doubly indirectly elected. Okay. The House, members of the House are in office for 2 years. Very democratic, although it's not so democratic as the members in the state legislatures who were elected for 1 year. It's twice as aristocratic as those terms of office of the state legislators. These people are twice as removed from direct popular control as the guys who were elected in the state houses of representatives. But four times as much removed as the men who were elected to be in the House of Representatives in Rhode Island. Those men were elected every 6 months. Very, very dependent upon the people, you see. These people in our House of Representatives, the National House, were removed more from popular will. Not quite so democratic as we thought it was, perhaps. We've seen that the size of this is large. Okay. Okay, let me talk about the House just for a minute. They wanted the House of Representatives to be there. in the governmental system for purposes of justice, for purposes of the preservation of liberty, because the people have a voice in the making of the laws. You can't just have the minority, the aristocracy, the few, you might say, through the Senate making laws. They've got to get the okay of the House, just as the House has to get the okay of the Senate in making laws. Okay, now suppose the House were not there. Suppose we had an aristocratic Senate, or more or less aristocratic Senate, indirectly elected, that is, elected by the state legislatures, chosen for six-year terms, the terms staggered so you can't get rid of all of them at once, it takes you three elections to do it, and so forth. Very small size. You have a presidency with just one man. We'll talk about that more. He's in there for 4 years, and he can succeed himself in office. Very important point. You have a Supreme Court that is small and is in there virtually for life. Suppose there were no popular branch of government. How do you suppose the American people, most of whom came from states which were a good deal more democratic than the central government, would have looked upon this? Suppose they would have accepted the Constitution? Not on your life. So they wanted this House of Representatives to be there for purposes of justice, for purposes of the preservation of liberty, but also for purposes of stability. That may sound strange in that the House is a more democratic branch and therefore is more likely to be swayed by popular opinion. But if you don't give popular opinion, the majority opinion, some voice in government, then the people are not going to trust your civil government, especially when they come from a tradition which is a tradition of Republican government, local self-government, and that sort of thing, as opposed to a tradition in which the people don't exercise any governmental authority. This popular branch then would win support for the Constitution, and it would win support of the people, the continuing support of the people for the civil government. That works for stability. It tends to work for the rule of law. Okay, but you do have these aristocratic checks on popular will, embodied particularly in the Senate, in the presidency, and in the Supreme Court. I can read some good quotes out of the Federalist about that, too. How it is the duty of the president not to follow every whim of the majority, but to stand against the majority will and to check unjust majority desires or unwise things that the majority does. How it is the duty of the Senate to do the same. And of course, when a bill becomes a law, it has to be approved by a majority of the House, plus a majority of the Senate, plus, assuming a veto is not overridden, the president. So you have the majority will being reflected in the, or having a voice in the making of law. You also have an institution which is biased toward the minority, having its voice toward the few, you might say, having its voice in the making of a law. This makes for stability. It makes for domestic tranquility. The few, the minority, are going to feel that their interests are being protected through the Senate. States are going to feel that their interests are being protected through the Senate. But the majority also is going to feel, I think rightly so, to a certain extent, that its interest is being protected through the House. Now, the Founding Fathers were not trying to design an infallible system. They knew they couldn't do that. They knew they were mere men and were designing governments to be run by men. But they did the best they could to design this elaborate system which would foster domestic tranquility, because you wouldn't have groups which would feel that they were being done wrong, so to speak, by the government. Which would foster stability, because you wouldn't have people who were not represented by the government seeking to overthrow it, so forth. Which would foster the rule of law, because the House would check against initiatives by the few, shall we say, and the few would be able to check against the impulses of majority will. Yes.
Special interest groups, now that the Senate isn't directly voted, mm-hmm. Do you feel as though that the special interest groups have more power and control than part of the government?
I would say so, yes. Well, even while we have become more democratic in form, in substance, I would say the special interest groups certainly have a lot more power than they used to. And the particular special interest group, I would say, is that has the most power is the news media. That is the liberals who dominate the news media and so forth, the humanists, whatever you want to call them. precisely because they can manipulate public opinion so well. We could spend more time profitably on this. Maybe I'll talk about that more tomorrow. But the direct election of senators removed this check that the whatever wisdom and knowledge you had in the state legislatures placed on the Senate and on the men who were elected to the Senate. Let me give you one illustration. Is people really in choosing senators very often do go for really superficial characteristics. One of my favorite examples is Senator Lawton Childs from Florida, who, even though he's a moderate liberal, was basically elected by the voters of Florida because he walked around the state. He had a gimmick. He walked around the state and said, "Hello, I'm Lawton Childs, and I want to be your senator." Most of the people in Florida at that time were conservative, basically. But Lawton Childs had a gimmick. The media picked up on it. The media liked him. Of course, that helps too. The publicity really is key. And publicized him, and he was able to overcome a beginning deficit in popularity and get himself elected on the basis of really superficial things. He didn't say much of what he stood for or anything, but people go for things like that. People also tend to vote for people on the basis more of appearance and that sort of thing, whether the guy's a pretty boy or whatever, than on the substance. I think it was Charles Burton Marshall, an old political scientist from Johns Hopkins, not a Christian, was visiting at Texas A&M when I was teaching there and told us the story of, I believe it was Joe Cannon, who used to be Speaker of the House. He was an ugly man, but a very brilliant man, evidently, and a pretty good legislator and so forth, who was accused one time of being two-faced. And he said, "If I had two faces, do you think I'd be wearing this one?" So my point is that a guy like, we don't elect too many ugly politicians these days, you know. But sometimes ugly folks are smarter than handsome folks, or beautiful, the beautiful people, shall we say. Smarter and, more importantly, more godly and so forth. More knowledgeable, what have you. And I very definitely think that the people, especially through the news media and what the news media prevents from coming before the public, people who've been involved in Right to Life activities know a lot about this, as well as with what they push before the public and drum into us the best they can, exercises all too much an undue influence, and of course special interest groups who are able to capture the news media's attention. Or, okay, all right. Let me just say a word to conclude the stability and the rule of law. These institutions were designed to promote stability in the civil government and thereby to promote the rule of law as opposed to the rule of men. Okay? They deliberately designed the Senate, the presidency, and the Supreme Court to promote stability, particularly against the popular winds. The best book that I know on this is Dr. Paul Eidelberg's book, The Philosophy of the American Constitution. I'm very greatly indebted to Dr. Eidelberg, who knows the Constitution inside and out, for pointing out these things. But if you read through the Federalist Papers, say, begin with Federalist 62 and read on through about Federalist 78, you'll see a lot of these things. Very finely stated by Madison and Hamilton. Now, let me just conclude with a short word on virtue and liberty. You'll see this more fully when I talk about the state constitution. And I could spend a long time talking about it, but let me boil it down for you. We are usually told that the men who framed the Constitution did not concern themselves with virtue, or that the men who framed and ratified the Constitution were not concerned with the moral virtue of the people. Most of the people who tell us this only tell it implicitly because they are not concerned about the moral virtue of the people. They are economic determinists who think everything is determined by the economic system you have, would like to have us have a socialist or a Marxist system. Or they are people who think that politics is simply a struggle between interest groups for power and for what you can get with the power that you have. Or there are a few people who are devotees of Plato and Aristotle and other ancient Greek philosophers who have made fairly good academic careers out of saying that the founding fathers really were not concerned to make the people virtuous like the ancient philosophers were. This latter group is concerned with virtue, but has not read our sources very well, nor have any of them read the sources very well, read our document, our governmental documents very well, or the pronouncements of the men who framed the Constitution, ratified the Constitution, our leading statesmen, and so forth, our state constitutions, and so forth. Now, this latter group that is concerned with making people be virtuous wants to have, basically, total power placed in the hands of central government so that it can control all areas of life, including education, the family, and so forth, and so that it can use its powers a la Plato, the philosopher kings, or the guardians who ruled Plato's, or who were supposed to have ruled Plato's Republic, to manipulate us into being virtuous. But the founding fathers wanted the government rather to, you might say, protect and foster virtue, not to use its power to make people be virtuous. They did design into the central government itself certain things which were designed to, certain attributes of office, which were designed to attract the best men to office. All the ladies will easily understand this. You want to attract the best man, you want to get the best man, and then you want to make him behave, okay? Basically, that's what they did through the design of the institutions in the central government. They wanted to give the Senate, for example, characteristics and attributes that would attract more excellent men to serve in the Senate. Okay? The fact that they are indirectly elected was one of the things. This was also the case of the presidency and Supreme Court. The fact that they had a longer tenure, a longer term of office, was very important for that too. Because the most excellent men want to do what they think is right. They don't necessarily want to follow every whim of the public. They don't want to be a computerized poll. They want to be a human being acting in accordance with what they consider right. The size of these institutions was important for this, because a small size, as we said the other day, fosters wisdom in your deliberations. It doesn't guarantee it, but it fosters it. Okay, so they designed these institutions then to foster wisdom. We must also notice, though, that the state and local governments very definitely had a role in fostering virtue. I spent a lot of time reading great quotes out of the state constitutions on this. But the local government definitely oversaw the morality of the people. You read the laws of the early states and you see that. There's no doubt about it. And moreover, the state constitutions had, in virtually all of them, state constitutions, declarations of rights, bills of rights, and so forth, very, very clearly had a teaching that the preservation of liberty depends on the preservation of morality in the people, the preservation of virtue in the people. And that the only way to preserve virtue in the people is to foster religion. Without religion, you don't have moral virtue. Without moral virtue, you don't have the continuance of liberty. George Washington, in his farewell address, in very famous lines, said in essence that those who suppose that you can preserve liberty without virtue and virtue without religion are out in left field, are all wet, are totally in error. You must foster religion in order to maintain moral virtue in the people, and must maintain that moral virtue in the people if you want to maintain your liberty.